From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Eric Westervelt.
I'm Jeremy Hobson, broadcasting today from WBEZ in Chicago. It's Here and Now. President Trump's former lawyer and fixer Michael Cohen is back on Capitol Hill today, testifying to House lawmakers behind closed doors. This after bruising public testimony yesterday in which he called President Trump a racist, a con man, and a cheat who directed Cohen to threaten others on his behalf. For their part, Republicans focused on the fact that Cohen has pleaded guilty to lying to Congress in the past and is going to prison in May. Joining us now from Washington is NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Hi, Mara.
Hi there.
So Cohen is behind closed doors today, as we said, in front of the House Intelligence Committee. What are they going to be asking him about today?
Well, I assume the House Intelligence Committee will want to focus more on the Russia part of this investigation, which Michael Cohen had a few things to say about yesterday. He said that he thinks that the president was aware of the WikiLeaks dump before it happened. He talks about a phone call that he says he witnessed between the president and Roger Stone. But at other times during his testimony, he said, I can't talk about that because that's something that the special counsel is looking into or the Southern District of New York is looking into. So there are some things that he could talk about in a closed session that he couldn't talk about yesterday.
He was asked yesterday whether he had evidence that the president colluded with the Russians. He said he didn't. But he was pressed by Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the Democrat, about whether he believed the president was capable of colluding. And here's what happened.
Mr. Trump is all about winning. And he will do what is necessary within
which
to win.
And in your opinion and experience, would he have the potential to cooperate or collude with a foreign power to win the presidency at all costs?
Yes.
What did you make, Mara, of how Democrats handled Michael Cohen yesterday?
Well, Republicans obviously handled him as somebody who's a liar and shouldn't be trusted on anything. Democrats are saying, here's a person who has nothing to lose. He's already said he was a liar. So they clearly are treating him as somebody who can provide them with some interesting clues and ideas about how to continue their own investigations. In other words, they don't have to take Michael Cohen's word for it. They can go ask David Pecker. They can go ask Alan Weisselberg, who worked for the CFO of the Trump Organization, mm-hmm. about some of these charges. What I think was really interesting was that the dilemma that Michael Cohen's testimony presented for Republicans is they want to say he's a liar, but on some things they want to say he's telling the truth. And the president, when he was in Vietnam yesterday, said Michael Cohen lied a lot, but he didn't lie about one thing. He didn't say he said he saw no evidence of collusion. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that puts the president and his party in a very difficult position. He says, I wonder why he didn't just lie about that, too, like he did about everything else.
What about the Republicans? As you said, they were calling Cohen a liar. But yesterday on NPR, after the hearings, Jim Jordan, the Republican congressman, was asked about some of the allegations from Cohen, including that the president signed a check while in office that Cohen says was reimbursement for the hush money payments. Let's listen.
I don't think the president has done anything wrong. I think what we've seen is what we already knew. We've seen that okay. We already knew that there were a number of payments made to Michael Cohen as part of a retainer agreement, which I think happens all the time with companies and their personal lawyers.
Okay, talking there with Mary Louise Kelly from All Things Considered.
Was so interesting about that is he never defended the president during mm-hmm. the hearings. That was kind of interesting because the Republicans never defended the president. They spent all their time trying to undermine Michael Cohen's credibility. That's not a hard thing to do. But they never defended the president. And as a matter of fact, whether or not these payments were part of a retainer agreement or to reimbursement for the hush money, that's mm-hmm. something that prosecutors are already looking into.
And Mara, just a few seconds left here, but what do you think this means for the president politically? What happened yesterday?
I don't know if this moved the needle politically for him. I think the significance of yesterday was that it was on television, even though a lot of the things mm-hmm. we already knew. But people had a chance to hear Michael Cohen, the person who worked for the president in this very, very top important capacity for 10 years talking about him. I think the most important thing is what this will lead to. You know, mm-hmm. will Michael Cohen's suggestions about who the Democrats should talk to be followed up? Will other people be subpoenaed, including the president's children?
NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson, thank you.
Thank you.
In Hanoi, President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un ended their summit early after failing to reach an agreement to bring an end to North Korea's nuclear program. At his press conference today, President Trump said North Korea needs to offer more before the U.S. will ease economic sanctions.
They were willing to denuke a large portion of the areas that we wanted, but we couldn't give up all of the sanctions for that.
CNN's Will Ripley joins us now by Skype from Hanoi. Will, thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you, Eric.
Were you surprised that the summit abruptly ended without a deal? Were diplomats there taken aback?
I think everybody was surprised. Nobody expected that the leader of the United States and the leader of North Korea would fly all the way to Hanoi only to have the talks end early and their working lunch be canceled. It's not the outcome that anyone expected. It took South Korea by surprise. They said they were perplexed. The same was true in China and Japan, all of them seeking clarity about what exactly went down. And as it turns out, they simply hadn't laid enough groundwork. The U.S. and North Korea ahead of this summit had not been successful in agreeing on a definition of denuclearization and how to phase in sanctions relief. Those were the big issues that really needed to be sorted out before Trump and Kim sat down in the room together. And if there was a hope that maybe they would just be able to kind of work things out on the fly, well, clearly we found out and they found out the hard way that wasn't possible.
Yeah, terms needed to be defined. Hard groundwork needed to be laid. What does this failure say about the way the Trump administration conducts diplomacy?
I think it's a really hard lesson for President Trump on the limits of a good personal relationship with Kim Jong-un, and also a lesson in the complexities of this situation. He was so quick to criticize, presidents before him. I mean, keep in mind, nearly a dozen U.S. presidents have tried and failed to make peace with North Korea precisely because it is such a difficult and long-standing issue. When you have two countries that have been enemies since the early 1950s, you have all of those decades of mistrust and division, and now you have a nuclear-armed North Korea that is holding on to this arsenal as what it views as its safety net, protecting it from enemy forces in the outside world. And it's not the kind of thing that you can just get a country like North Korea that doesn't trust anybody outside of its own borders to just relinquish. And I think initially President Trump thought that the personal relationship would take him farther than it can.
There are no plans as yet for a third summit or for more immediate talks between the U.S. and North Korea. Is South Korea left with their mouth open a little bit, wondering what just happened?
Absolutely. President Moon Jae-in was really counting on a positive outcome for this summit because he was hoping that Kim Jong-un would make an historic visit to Seoul, possibly this spring. Well, now that Hanoi has resulted in a big fat nothing, what incentive does Kim Jong-un have to go to Seoul unless South Korea is willing to unilaterally take action to lift its own sanctions on North Korea and potentially alienate its key ally, the United States? So it's really putting President Moon in a difficult situation, even though he is still moving forward with plans to have a joint team for the Tokyo 2020 Olympics, and North and South Korea even put in a joint bid for 2032. Almost like President Moon is trying to use sporting events to lock in diplomacy, regardless of how these other negotiations go.
We've got bromance diplomacy and sports diplomacy, potentially. Will, I have to ask you, the North Korean leader, he's a dictator. There are not press freedoms there. They have a horrific human rights record, and he does not usually take any questions from reporters from the foreign press, but he did today. Tell us about that and perhaps its meaning.
It was an extraordinary moment when a reporter, first from the Washington Post and then others in the White House pool, were able to ask Kim Jong-un questions, and he responded. And they were not hardball questions. If they were, I don't think Kim would have answered. But simply the fact that he did shows that he is also perhaps opening up, changing his approach when it comes to dealing with the foreign media. I mean, look, I've been going to North Korea for more than 4 years now, and we, along with every other news organization on earth, would love to sit down and interview Kim Jong-un. And it has, always been something that the North Koreans have dangled as a possibility way down the road. Maybe Kim now sees the benefit of speaking directly to the Western media to try to get his message out there. That said, North Korea is still incredibly restrictive on press access, and they've actually clamped down even more since this diplomatic detente began. Now that things haven't gone so well with President Trump, I do wonder if they might open up again in hopes of using the media to get a message back to the United States and back to President Trump.
And perhaps the biggest thing to come out of this failed summit could be those sort of minor thawing of relations when it comes to things like press freedoms. Who knows?
Absolutely. And I do need to also point out that what I found quite stunning was President Trump's defense of Kim Jong-un over the case of Otto Warmbier, the American student who died 6 days after he was released from North Korean custody. To say that Kim Jong-un didn't really know how Otto Warmbier was being treated, I just don't buy that. Kim Jong-un certainly was complicit in the deception in keeping Otto basically hooked up to a machine for far longer than North Korea should have before revealing to the United States his medical condition, allowing him to get on a plane and get in, you know, in front of some doctors who could have been able to help him. And for President Trump to kind of gloss over that and defend Kim Jong-un based on his personal relationship, I do have to wonder how that is going to go over in the United States, and certainly how that will be received by the Warmbier family.
It was an extraordinary moment of the President of the United States defending a dictator. Will Ripley, a CNN international correspondent. Will, thanks so much.
Great to be with you.
I'm broadcasting the show today from Chicago, where voters just guaranteed that the city will have a black woman as mayor for the first time ever. In an election on Tuesday, attorney Lori Lightfoot and Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle, both black women, advanced to a runoff election, which will happen on April 2nd. There's only been one black mayor in Chicago history, even though about a third of the population is black. But Chicago has lost a significant portion of its black population since 1980. And by 2030, Chicago's black population is on track to shrink to 665,000, down from a peak of about 1.2 million. That's according to the Urban Institute of Chicago. So why are so many African Americans leaving? I asked Teresa Cordova, the director of the Great Cities Institute at the University of Illinois at Chicago.
In a lot of these neighborhoods where we're seeing the largest amount of decline, those are also neighborhoods where you have a lot of job loss. Particularly since 1975, 19 into the 80s, you saw a lot of job loss. And along with that job loss, you saw disinvested neighborhoods with declines in anchor institutions, the corner grocery stores, the even schools we've seen in the last few years, a lot of schools have left. So that overall in these conditions of disinvestment, people are weighing their options and saying, well, we might want to stay in Chicago. We can't afford to live in other neighborhoods, and we don't want to stay in this neighborhood anymore either because there aren't the amenities for us, there aren't the services, there aren't the quality schools, and in fact, we're seeing the violence here. So I think that also contributes to why people are leaving.
Why is this disinvestment going on more in these African-American neighborhoods than in other parts of Chicago?
I think part of it is one, because a lot of the disinvestment occurred in the first place because of the loss of manufacturing. When you compare over time where jobs were, you can see that these neighborhoods had a lot of employment opportunities. There were a lot of anchor employment centers. Those are gone for the most part from these neighborhoods, and they weren't replaced. Where you're seeing more development is in the Loop and the downtown area and in the northwest side of Chicago and the northwest suburbs.
But when you talk about a population loss, you said 33%. The city of Chicago hasn't gone down by that much. So who's coming in to replace this population?
Chicago's population overall peaked in 1950, and then we saw a decline. And what we saw there it was part of the suburbanization, where whites were leaving the city and moving to the suburbs. There were all kinds of reasons why that occurred, including federal subsidies and the creation of highways and so on. And now they've come back, and they're coming back.
That's not great news for Kristen Ware, who is seeing living costs going up. She lives in Chicago's Hyde Park neighborhood with her 2-year-old son, Caden, and her 10-year-old dog, Rocco.
Rocco, you're going to be on the radio. Come here.
Ware is 40 years old. She grew up in Milwaukee and moved to Chicago in 2002 to pursue a career in marketing. She says she loves the city but is selling her townhouse to upgrade to a much bigger place in Charlotte, North Carolina.
As much as I love the city and the friend base that I've developed here, I just feel like the cost of living is getting out of control, so I need to go someplace where my dollar's just going to stretch a little bit further. And then also the school system here just isn't the best, and there's a lot of things that go along with getting into the schools that are really good in the city. So it's very competitive. from that standpoint. And then the weather. I used to travel a lot to Charlotte and Atlanta for my previous job. And when you travel to warmer places in the wintertime, you realize you're making a choice to live in the cold weather.
Ware is also expecting to pay a lot less in taxes by leaving Illinois.
There's a lot of things like that. The sugar tax turned me off. That was one thing I did not like. I just feel like they're just nickel and diming you with the bag tax, and then they wanted to do the sugar tax. Like, do a better job managing your money and your and the budgets you have. Because that's what we have to do.
Here.
Yeah, I think we are overtaxed here, and I think the cost of living is constantly going up, and we're not getting compensated to, you know, properly adjust to that cost of living increase that we're facing.
There's another reason Ware decided to leave Chicago. She says she wants to raise her 2-year-old son somewhere with lots of opportunity.
I'm raising a black male in America, so I want to make sure that I give him the opportunity to have affluent role models that he can be around and see successful black people. That's important to me for him to see success.
And you don't see that here?
No, I do see it in Chicago. I definitely see it in Chicago. And that was why it was important to me to pick another city where I knew he would see that as well and have the opportunity to have some mentoring and stuff.
For Catherine Welch, the reason for leaving Chicago wasn't economic. It was about safety. She was born and raised in Chicago, but after 26 years in the city, she moved to the suburb of South Holland to be closer to her parents.
I'm a single woman living alone, and safety is my number one concern. I don't have to look over my shoulder every time I pull in the garage to wonder, is someone following me in? Is someone going to attack me? Granted, there's crime everywhere, but I feel really safe where I am. I don't feel, as I do here, that there will be a gunshot at any point.
Here is an intersection on Chicago's south side, 79th and Racine, to be exact. Catherine met us in the office of the Greater Auburn Gresham Development Corporation near where she works and where she once had her own brush with gun violence.
It was a summer day. I was walking to Walgreens and I heard these pops and I saw gunfire from the alleyway and I saw a kid running eastbound and I didn't know where he was going to run. And at that moment, I felt helpless. And unless someone's been, and there's been a number of people who've been exposed to that, but it's such a helpless feeling to know that someone has a gun and you're in an environment that you can't get away from immediately. And I had to scramble to get the key to get back into the office. And that had an impact on me. Now, granted, that type of experience is very, very small compared to a lot of the parents who have lost their children or people who witness someone being shot or seeing a dead body lay in the ground on the ground for hours at a time. But at that moment, I just felt so vulnerable and felt no matter what I did, I had such little control over that moment of where I was. I may park in that lot. There's any given day I could be walking down the street to run an errand or to go to my car if it's parked over in that direction. So no, I do not want to come back to Chicago for mainly that reason. If I had a family of small children, I probably would even not move back to Chicago because I would think about their well-being and their education. And good schools are primarily in good communities. And I want to say good communities that have less crime, communities where there aren't as many boarded up homes, communities in which more affluent people live.
Do you think of yourself as part of, when we hear about a lot of the black population of Chicago leaving the city, either to go to the suburbs or to leave the state altogether and maybe go to the south, do you think of yourself as part of that, that migration out of the city because of crime, economic opportunity, whatever it might be?
Yes, I would say definitely for that reason.
Do you think that there's hope for the city to turn things around and make this neighborhood safe?
I would say absolutely. There's definitely an opportunity for things to turn around because there are great people. We have great public officials, great faith-based communities, great community organizations that are doing great work to stabilize communities like this. And there's been a lot of good things done. It's just going to take more time. But I do think there's turnaround. And I think that turnaround will come when there's more opportunities job-wise, as well as people staying in the community. I think that's going to be a factor. As much as I say I won't come back to Chicago, I think people staying where they are and stabilizing that block will make a difference. And there are people who are doing that work.
But you think the first thing that has to be done is to deal with the crime so that the area is safe?
Absolutely.
And, says urban planning professor Teresa Cordova, the city has to make sure that it's allowing people who have made these neighborhoods their home for decades to stay in the new Chicago.
Chicago is probably not going to be the city that it is today in 10 years. In 10 years, the city of Chicago is going to be a very different place. The biggest issue right now with this urban restructuring that's occurring is we're seeing economic growth in the downtown area, in the Loop area, and we're seeing that the disinvestment and the abandonment of the neighborhoods. And so what has to happen is that those neighborhoods that have been abandoned, we need to reinvest back in those neighborhoods. We need capital investment. We need anchor institutions. But it needs to be done in a way that people who live in those neighborhoods can remain in those neighborhoods. The gentrification process occurs when you invest back in those neighborhoods, but the people who've been there can't afford to stay there. So the question is, how do you revitalize without displacing people?
So a big question there for the city of Chicago. As you may have heard, I was not in Chicago yesterday. I was in Washington anchoring NPR's coverage of the Michael Cohen hearings, which means that some of the stories we wanted to bring you yesterday from Chicago are going to have to wait a bit, but we will bring them to you, and they are a lot of fun. We're going to tour some of Chicago's architectural landmarks with the Pulitzer Prize-winning architecture critic for the Chicago Tribune, who believes, as many do, that Chicago has the best architecture in America. We will visit Fermilab, a national lab outside Chicago that's become the global center of research into subatomic particles called neutrinos. And we will meet some of the people who come here from all over the country to study improv comedy. It is inspiring.
Here and Now is supported by LegalZoom, who wants you to know that if you want to make 2019 the year you finally start a business or secure your family's future, LegalZoom can help. With their network of independent attorneys licensed in all 50 states, LegalZoom can help you navigate your legal needs from wills and trusts to LLCs, trademarks, contract reviews, and more. And the best part is, LegalZoom is not a law firm, so they don't charge by the hour. More at LegalZoom.com/now.
Spiked seltzer water, organic low-carb beers. Is this really the future for beer giant Anheuser-Busch? It just might be. The company is forecasting higher growth this year, in part because of its push into these alternative beverages. For more, let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
Mr. Westervelt, how are you?
Good to talk to you. So Anheuser-Busch has been having a bit of a hard time in the U.S. Fewer people are drinking, you know, these flagship brands, Bud and Bud Light. The shift, you know, among people has really been towards craft beers, liquor, and wine. Are they really looking at alcoholic water and these other kind of drinks as their big savior?
I mean, these guys are throwing all sorts of carbonation at the wall. As you described, the mega shift is away from full carb, full sugar, global flagship brands, not just Bud, but think Coke and Pepsi as well. Because the growth markets are craft beer and funky derivatives with varying degrees of alcohol and fruitiness and other things.
Interesting. So, I mean, I saw they're trying out Bud Lime, which I have to confess I have not tried, energy drinks, even cocktails in a can. I mean, have you tried any of these? I mean, are they any good?
I haven't, honestly. I mean, I save my alcoholic calories for the occasional Bartles and James or Zima, which is kind of in and out of a comeback. And I'll even enjoy a Four Loko once or twice a year.
Nice. I'm more of an IPA kind of guy with some wine thrown in there. I heard the company's also experimenting with cannabis drinks in Canada, partnering with cannabis company Tilray to make a THC drink and a CBD version that is not intoxicating. Is weed water or weed beer, I guess, part of their future too?
These guys are spreading their bets into anything that effervesces of growth, as it were. Soon you're going to see, you know, big tobacco and big vape branch into pot and eventually big soda too. You know, maybe by 2030, the Keebler Elves will be toking it up as well.
I think they already have. It's kind of like the Kraft Heinz, which saw its stock take a hit again this week. I mean, people just want healthier food. I guess people just don't want to drink a hot dog and eat a hot dog and drink a Bud at the ballpark like they used to or something.
Yeah, I mean, all joking aside, big food, if you think about Heinz, Kraft, Pepsi, Coke, and the mega brewers, they're really – I mean, it's really sweating the shift away from huge name brands with conventional ingredients. At the ballpark with my son, for example, I have my choice of several regional craft beers and a nitrate-free turkey sausage. My kid doesn't even know what a Coca-Cola is. At his age, I was the Big Mac and Coke guy.
I mean, are there other companies, beverage companies you've seen that have been able to evolve and roll with these consumer taste punches?
Think about LaCroix water that came back out of nowhere, and that's the go-to soft drink for millennials. And look how much Pepsi hustled to promote its knockoff, Bubbly, Buble, whatever, during the Super Bowl. Honest Tea, which I believe was acquired by Coke, that's flying off store shelves. And some of the fastest growing brands in consumer packaged goods, they're just very mindful of ingredients and simplicity and low carb and sugar counts.
While we're talking about consumer taste, here's an interesting one. Energizer, the battery company, is jumping into the phone business with a new phone that has some 50 days of battery life. It's being called the thick boy on Twitter. How thick are we talking about here, Robin?
I mean, it looks like the thickness of three smartphones. And while it might not burn a hole in your wallet, I'm not so sure it won't overheat and literally burn a hole in your pocket.
Light beer and heavy phones. Robin Farzad hosts Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. My pleasure.
I'm in Chicago today, where this week voters decided who will face off in April in the race to replace Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel. There is going to be a runoff because none of the 14 candidates on the ballot got 50% of the vote or even close. The top two candidates are former federal prosecutor Lori Lightfoot and Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle. Both black women and notably former White House Chief of Staff Bill Daley did not make it to the runoff. Joining us now are two Chicago political reporters, Josh McGee with The Chicago Reporter. Hi, Josh.
How are you doing?
And doing well. And WBEZ reporter Claudia Morell is with us as well. Hi, Claudia.
Hi.
So let's start with some tape of the candidates after the votes came in on election night. Here is Lori Lightfoot.
This election was going to be about whether or not we are resigned to the status quo or whether we are resolved to fight for what's right. It's about whether we will accept only investing in the downtown while neighborhoods cry out for attention and resources, or whether we're committed to making sure that every neighborhood is safe.
And here is Tony Preckwinkle.
Let's first acknowledge how hard we worked to get here. We worked shoulder to shoulder to shape a campaign that reflects our vision, our values, and our hopes for Chicago.
Okay, so two black women. There's only been one black mayor of Chicago ever. And one of the candidates, Lori Lightfoot, is a lesbian. Josh, what do you make of the results?
I think one key thing is people are talking about criminal justice reform. Mm-hmm. So Lori Lightfoot, as a person who's worked with police, with COPA, she has been taking that very seriously. What do people who are police, who are they going for? What do they want to see? And Lori Lightfoot kind of shined ahead. So it's a very key issue in Chicago, and especially with the police consent decree coming up.
What about the fact, though, that the two candidates, that Chicago's going to have a black mayor and a black woman mayor?
It is pretty remarkable and historic, the election, but it was also somewhat of a long time coming, given the issues that have been boiling in Chicago as it relates to the Laquan McDonald video and the
this
fallout.
This is the black teenager who was shot by a Chicago police officer fatally. And there was a whole controversy about the camera footage of that and how quickly that came out to the public and what was done to the police afterwards.
Right. The police officer, Jason Van Dyke, was just convicted of a murder.
Well, there was a federal decree also. The federal government even got involved to try to fix the police force after that had happened. So that was a big issue in this election.
Yeah, the DOJ had to come in and they found that there was significant issues with the police department. And then on top of that, we have major pension issues in Chicago where we have also one of the highest sales tax rates in the country. Property taxes are going extremely high. And this is one of the reasons why corruption was such a big issue in the election, because the Cook County, Chicago is a city within Cook County, and the Cook County property tax system was, it was made known that, you know, if you had a lot of money and you could fight your property tax bills, you know, you got underassessed. And if you didn't have a lot of money, that you got overassessed and you end up paying more. Mm-hmm. And so that was the start of the seeds for a lot of this corruption talk.
What about the fact that Adeley had to give a concession speech? That never happens in the city of Chicago. What do you think about the fact that the Daley machine, this is Bill Daley, he's the brother of the former mayor Richard Daley and the son of the other former mayor Richard Daley, both of whom spent a long time in the mayor's office. What do you make of the fact, Josh, that Bill Daley didn't make it this time?
The simplest way to put it is that in Chicago, the Democratic machine runs deep, so it's not just Daley, though Daley would be the headline if you're thinking mm-hmm. about it. But there's more than one machine candidate running. So him not being here is kind of the story of how this race is going to be. Bill Daley, Willie Wilson, these are other people who had a ton of votes. So where do the Daley votes go? Do they automatically line up for Tony Perkwink, or do they go somewhere else? That's more of the topic of conversation. There's 14 candidates for mayor. So even more than Bill Daley, I would look at Willie Wilson, who's
a businessman.
Businessman who's an outsider, who isn't the most PC person. But he
didn't make it into the finals.
Right, but he got 11% of the votes. Right. And this is a guy who was handing out cash at churches.
He actually was
to help people with their property tax bills.
To help people with their property taxes.
That's a good way to get votes. What about Rahm Emanuel, the mayor now? Why didn't he run again? Do we have any sense of that, Claudia?
Yeah, Emanuel really had no path to victory. It started with the Laquan McDonald video, which, you know, remember, the shooting was in October of 2014. Emanuel was reelected in 2015, and the video was made public that Thanksgiving of 2015. Mm-hmm. And so it really was something that he had to deal with from the start of his term to the end. And, you know, there was a lot of protests happening at City Hall, you know, 16 shots and a cover-up. People would come every day and interrupt meetings. And I wanted to make a comment on the Daley surprise. I was actually surprised that Daley jumped into the race, because Emanuel, for the past 4 years, has spent a lot of energy essentially accusing Daley's brother, Richard M., of putting Chicago in its current fiscal climate that it is, saying that, you know, this is why he was elected so many times. You know, he kept taxes artificially low. They borrowed a whole bunch of money. And now, you know, future generations are going to have to pay that. And Emanuel had to fill each budget, borrow about $2 billion.
So when we hear about that, and that gets to the issue of the fact that Chicago has some debt problems. We've talked about corruption as an issue. We've talked about criminal justice reform. These are all parts of what's going on here. We've been reporting on the black population loss that's going on in Chicago and has been for a number of years. What would you say, Josh, is the thing that Chicago voters really want the next mayor to tackle first? What is the most important issue for voters here?
Because Lori Lightfoot received so many votes, I would say criminal justice reform. But there's a lot of big issues. There's a huge fire and police training academy that's coming to the west side that there has been protest about, not specifically in the ward, but from people in Chicago, the young black voters in Chicago. But also one thing is the Obama Presidential Center.
Which is going to be built in Chicago.
Which is going to be built in Jackson Park as of now, but there's a lawsuit pending about it. But yes, that's going to be a big deal, because it's a talk about public land, private use of public land, or if the Obama Foundation is actually a private entity, or is it for the public?
Interesting.
So there's a lot of things, and there was something on the ballot about a community benefits agreement, which is a real microcosm of Chicago, is if the community should have some input in the changes that will happen from the Obama Presidential Center, which might be higher rents, which might be affordable housing. So yeah, that's one of the big things.
So there's another issue that I noticed. It looks like it probably has less likelihood of happening now, which is Elon Musk wanted to build this very high speed train, essentially, from O'Hare Airport to downtown, a Hyperloop.
Yeah.
And Bill Daley was kind of the only candidate that was in favor of that. But He didn't win.
Yeah, most Chicagoans actually hate the plan because of the traffic to the airport already.
Okay. I want to ask you each, just in a few seconds we have left here, if there's a story that we're not paying attention to here that we should be. Claudia.
Yeah. In Chicago, I thought it was fascinating how fast the Chicago Police Department was able to close the Jesse Smollett case, given that, you know, our clearance rate in homicides is atrocious. We probably... I think the last numbers that I saw for the Chicago Police Department is that they solve 1 in 20 homicides.
Wow. So, and that Jesse Smollett case went very fast. What about you, Josh?
Yeah, it's for me, it's the community benefits agreement. People are talking about it on the ground there, and this will reshape the landscape of Chicago and the south side of Chicago, where there hasn't been that much investment.
See, we went through 10 minutes, and we didn't even talk about R. Kelly or really Jesse Smollett, except for that little mention of it right there at the end. WBEZ reporter Claudia Morell and Josh McGee with the Chicago Reporter. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
There are intensive efforts underway today to try to ease tensions between India and Pakistan. The nuclear-armed nations struck each other with retaliatory airstrikes this week following a suicide car bombing that killed at least 40 Indian police officers in Indian-controlled Kashmir earlier this month. This is the most serious military confrontation between the nuclear neighbors in two decades. Today, in a sign of possible de-escalation, Pakistan's prime minister said his country would release a captured Indian fighter pilot shot down this week. President Trump talked about the situation before he left the summit in Vietnam.
We have, I think, reasonably attractive news from Pakistan and India. They've been going at it, and we've been involved in trying to have them stop. And we have some reasonably decent news. I think, hopefully, that's going to be coming to an end. It's been going on for a long time, decades and decades.
The BBC's Tahrir Imran joins us from Islamabad. Tahrir, tell us about this expected release of the Indian pilot and whether that's expected to cool things down.
It was really unexpected. And the way the events turned out, I mean, definitely, as somebody pointed out on Twitter, that Imran Khan knows how to stay in headlines. So he finished his statement in the parliament, and then it seemed that he's leaving, and suddenly he decided to come back and say, by the way, in a very casual way, he said that we have decided to basically release the Indian pilot as a gesture of peace. And that was the most, I think, important part of his speech, because everybody forgot what he said before, and that is the headline now. So in a clear indication, that has somewhat taken the vacuum or the steam out of this whole frenzy that was ongoing from last 3 days. But still, there are unease in the environment in Islamabad.
Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan said Pakistan wants peace, but that should not be treated as our weakness. So a bit of a warning there. How has this gesture of possible release of the pilot been received in New Delhi?
There is silence from Delhi, like journalists, and if you believe the hysteria and the sort of like warmongering happening on social media and the conventional media, they are considering as a sort of like a position of strength that Pakistan has decided to do that. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of other people who are saying that it's a very sensible thing to do at this time, as compared to the last time when an Indian pilot was caught by Pakistanis who was kept in Pakistan for some time, and it was quite an issue to get him out of this country. Mm. So as compared to that, this is seen as a very interesting development. And on top of that, the American involvement is also being discussed. And as people know now, that Donald Trump spoke about it, the American president spoke about this issue, and diplomats in Islamabad are saying that Americans have basically involved in this situation, and they were quite instrumental in de-escalating the situation right as it is happening now.
Tahrir, you mentioned the sort of warmongering on social media and the regular media, and of course both countries have nuclear weapons. How close did the countries come this week, do you think, to a wider military conflict?
I am living in Islamabad from past 7 years, and in my whole life, I have only once felt that we were quite near to war, and this is the second time. And there were fighter jets flying over. There were like military convoys moving from A position to B. And then last night there were blackouts in certain areas. And today Prime Minister Imran Khan said that they were fearing that India would strike with a missile attack. So, and that's in its anticipation, they shut down the airspace for commercial airliners, which is still shut down. Thousands of people are stranded across the world in at different airports. There are like
no airlines are getting in and out. Wow.
No, there were like there were few planes stranded in Pakistan of Gulf Airlines, and they have taken those planes back, but there is no other airline coming to Pakistan right now. Just few planes of PIA came back from Dubai, and that's it. So the airspace is clear, and if you look at the flight radar or such apps, you can see they are clearly avoiding the eastern border of Pakistan, going through Arabian Sea, and then taking the route over Dubai and onwards to Europe. So it's quite tense, and I think it was very there have been strikes in Indian Pakistani administered Kashmir, but striking inside Pakistan was taken as a major thing. And when Pakistan retaliated, a lot of people were nervous that where this going to end. Still, that nervousness exists because the airspace is closed. There are still movements going on. Fighter jets still take off and land. So I'm not sure how this sense of ease will come back.
The BBC's Tahrir Imran speaking with us from Islamabad. Tahrir, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Eric Westervelt.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Our stories from Chicago were produced by Marcel Hutchins and Chris Bentley. This is Here and Now.